I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. What was happening on the cinema scene a half century ago? And how have movies changed, and in what ways have they remained the same? Believe it or not, 50 years ago means 1962, and with us are DVD gurus Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck to jump back 50 years to share their favorite films from that memorable year. You'll probably recognize these greats, the epic Oscar-winning Lawrence of Arabia, the highly controversial Lolita, and the film that launched a 50-year-long Bond series, Dr. No. Today we'll talk about how popular culture of 1962 influenced Hollywood, what effect films had on Americans then, and how the motion picture business has changed in the five decades since. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. 1962. Oh, what a year it was. It was the year of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the year the U.S. began gaining a firmer foothold in a place called Vietnam. Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann was executed in Israel. And it was also the year of some great films. Dr. No, Lawrence of Arabia, The Manchurian Candidate, and Lolita. Today, our DVD gurus, Mitch and Jason, will talk to us about those films and others and look how the film industry has changed in the intervening 50 years. Mitch is Mitch Bryan, a screenwriter, UMKC film prof, and writer for 435 South magazine. Mitch, good morning.
It's nice to see you.
Jason is Jason Heck, film critic for Inc. magazine at the Kansas City Star. Good morning.
Good morning, little brother. How are
you? Nice to have you here. Well, Mitch, why 1962?
50 is a nice round number, isn't it?
Isn't it, though? It all fits.
We always do one show a year where we pick a year and kind of look at the movies. Mm-hmm. So we were thinking, well, 50 years ago, what has happened in the last 50 years?
And then a lot.
50 years, it's 1962. It's not 1950 anymore, you know? I mean, we have moved into the second half of the 20th century when we get to 1962.
And what a difference from where we stand today as a society and where we were back then, Cuban Missile Crisis, the Cold War, very tense kind of time, right?
And there's probably a case to be made of some similarities with today. I think that, at least as far as the movies are concerned, 62 is this interesting period, and you'll see this as we go through these movies, where it was on the verge of a big transition. There was still an adherence to an old way of making movies, an old business model for making movies, and that would eventually change dramatically. The studios would collapse, the vacuum would be filled by young, new filmmakers, and then ultimately the studios would discover that there is big money to be made in the movies. Mm-hmm. We'll be looking at what kind of business some of these films did, looking at them in terms of adjusted dollars, and the first thing we'll notice is it's nothing compared to the kind of money that movies make today.
Really?
The bad news, I guess, though, is that it's also a period where this change that was in the wind, I think, is very similar to what's going to happen now. I mean, Hollywood right now is in big trouble.
They're
spending way too much money making these movies that audiences aren't particularly interested in seeing. They're competing with other ways of watching films. They're trying to hit a home run every time, and that philosophy is not necessarily working. And so I do kind of feel like maybe we're in a period similar to the early 60s where we're on the verge of something really big happening. And, you know, just like then, nobody likes change.
Yeah.
But change is coming, folks. It's got to.
Well, Jason, to what extent did all this sort of early turmoil churning around in the early 60s sort of show up in the movies that were made back then? What do you see?
Well, these movies that we're going to be looking at today are not – Mitch and I were talking earlier. Like, if you look at 1967, it's a revolutionary period in movies. These are evolutionary. These are movies that are sort of are taking very obvious steps away from – the bigger A-list movies that you're seeing, sort of like Lawrence of Arabia. Hey, I'm going to make a four-hour movie, and I'm going to go to the middle of Jordan, and I'm not going to have a love story, and I'm going to have not a lot of dialogue.
That's a four-hour movie. You don't see those anymore.
It's unconventional, but in some ways, it's also kind of a very typical epic in its scale and its scope and its spectacle. So the movies that we're going to be looking at are not necessarily radically different, not like what Bonnie and Clyde was in 67 or, yeah, or even really what In the Heat of the Night was in 67, but we're going to be looking at movies that are beyond and above in terms of ideas, in terms of sort of new craftsmanship, things like handheld cameras, the Mitchell camera, which kind of changed a lot of stuff, this handheld camera that more guys started using. They're just a little bit different and a little bit better and a little bit more timeless than some of the other stuff. Like, not a lot of people today are going to be busting out In Search of the Castaways.
Yeah.
but, you know, if you ask someone who likes film about Lawrence of Arabia, they will be – there's sort of just kind of a dreamy – oh, wow, I could talk to you about Lawrence of Arabia quite a bit.
Yeah.
And these are movies that and certainly find me a movie that's lasted the test of time more than Dr. No, I would be shocked.
Well, Mitch Bryan, why weren't the films of 62 making the kind of bucks then that movies make today? What was it? Was America just not a movie-going society much in those days, or what's your sense?
I think it had more to do with the way that these pictures were distributed. Mm. Today, a movie will open in, 1,000, 2,000 theaters all at the same time. You know, you don't have to stand in line to see a movie anymore because there are so many screens that picture is
in
playing
on. In those days,
on.
You had to stand in line.
Yeah, because the attitude now is you're going to get as much money as you can that opening window, and then you're going to move on to another film the next weekend, basically. That's the strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So back in the 60s, movies would come and – sometimes you'd have a movie that would run for 2 years, in the same town, or certainly would run for several months.
Yeah.
But you'd have to wait until it came to your town because there were not as many prints, and so that became one of many things that changed after Jaws, The Exorcist,
yeah,
The Godfather in the 70s, when people really started to figure out what kind of money you could make. But just in terms of just if you look at it in terms of adjusted dollars, Lawrence of Arabia was the biggest movie of 1962. In adjusted dollars, it made $140 million.
Wow.
That's a lot of money.
But
today,
nothing.
That's nothing. They want to make movies that make $200 million, which means – and so your production costs are different. In Search of the Castaways made about $70 million. And, of course, as Jason said, that's kind of a forgettable movie. But by and large, here, as you look at the top 10, you're seeing films that are – the big hits are movies that make about $50 million in 1962 in adjusted dollars. And $50 million is what it costs to make a movie today.
Mm. Jason, how watchable are the films of 62 today? As you watch them today, is there anything missing, anything lacking, or are they just pretty darn good?
The movies that we're looking at all touch on kind of different things. They're all watchable for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But, Dr. No is again, this perfect example. It's a movie that kind of has everything, and Mitch is certainly going to elaborate on how it fits into the sort of the Cold War and all of this other stuff in 62, but it's great score, gorgeous location, unbelievably charismatic leading man, great villain. Dr. No is as timeless as a movie can get. Now, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, it's John Ford, but it's Paramount's backlot. It looks more confined than a normal film. We probably wouldn't, people today, younger people especially, might get bored by this, not simply by black and white cinematography, although a shocking number of people don't enjoy black and white mm-hmm. movies. You all need to learn to enjoy black and white movies.
Yeah.
But, it's a movie that feels very confined, and it doesn't have the sort of the action, the oomph that we've come to expect. Movies today, an argument can be made that they're quite a bit dumber than they were in 1962.
Yeah.
We like stuff fed to us as audiences. We eschew challenging movies. We don't like complication, especially American audiences. We like black and white. And I don't mean cinematography. I mean in terms of problem resolution.
Right.
These movies there's much more ambiguity in a lot of these pictures that we're looking at, Lolita especially. And certainly The Manchurian Candidate is a very ambiguous film.
Yeah.
So I think an argument can be made that they were smarter. Movie going back then, you could still maybe construe as kind of an event. This might be something that you still put a tie on to do. And it was, people didn't go just for spectacle or sensory stuff. They went for ideas. They went to be challenged a little bit.
You know, Mitch, you mentioned the whole notion of Hollywood being in trouble, and certainly when Steve and Cynthia and Bob Butler, our film critics, are in here, they were talking about that as well. What's your sense, you know, in terms of where Hollywood is these days? Box office at the lowest point since 2001, I believe, just based on the recent stats I've seen. You do get a sense people aren't buzzing, aren't talking about films anywhere close to what they used to. I'm just wondering why and what does this portend down the road?
I think for me, it's the lack of people taking chances. The idea is you're making these movies for so much money, you have to hit the
middle, the big
soft center of the market. But the problem is that even those people at the soft center of the market are kind of ready for something a little different.
Yeah.
And I just think nobody's taking any chances. There's also no real pressure from the outside, from other countries making films that are going to be influencing the American filmmakers. I mean, there are great films being made, for example, in South Korea, and yet they don't seem to be influencing Hollywood very much, you know. Whereas you look at 62, and the other thing that was happening was last year at Marienbad and Le Dulos and Sanjuro and Winter Light by Bergman, all these amazing films that were coming in from Europe and Asia that were redefining and re-exploring, you know, the art form of cinema. I'm at the point now where I'm sort of feeling like cinema is dead. And it's going to take somebody, you know, something to come along and bring it back to life, because I just think movies are right now. And I really thank goodness we have home video and can watch lots of old films.
Well, you do wonder, Jason, you know, if folks get into the mindset, if they begin to develop habits of not going to the theater, that really begins to snowball on itself
Netflix
after a while,
comes
doesn't
right
it?
To your TV. Well, you don't even have to get up. No, these are things that are challenging. Think about 62. Think about the 50s. Television's coming up big. What do they come up with? They come up with CinemaScope. They come up with Cinerama. They come up with 3D. These are all technologies that were used to get people away from their TVs. You know, it's tough to compete with, you know, Superman on TV, which is being made for $500 an episode, when you're out there trying to throw up How the West Was Won. So, you know, to a certain extent, they have that now. We are bombarded. We have 400 TV channels we can look at. The audience has never been as fragmented as it is now. In summer, what are we aiming at? We're aiming at guys 25 and under. Everybody else, you know, if you were born with ovaries, forget it. There's nothing really made for you in summer unless Sandra Bullock has been interested in the script. Mm-hmm. So in summer, they're throwing what? Lately, superheroes. Well, we had what? Thor, Green Lantern, and Captain America didn't do much business. Mm-hmm. Guys didn't want to go see this. Why? Well, I don't know. Is it the Xbox? Is it the internet? Who knows? But there are a lot of things competing for people's attention in the marketplace.
Do you think cinema is dead, as Mitch just said?
Well, not as long as Michael Bay is out there carrying the torch for quirky little art house hits. No, you know, there are certainly directors out there who fight to keep stuff different. You know, I mean, the Coens are, you know, people like that. People like Christopher Nolan, although Mitch and I differ a little bit on Christopher Nolan. But the Coens, Scorsese to a certain extent, these are people who can make generally movies that are interesting, challenging, sometimes throwbacks to better times. But you know what? I mean, honestly, Michael Bay, Mitch and I were talking about Armageddon. No shot is longer than 7 seconds in this movie.
Wow.
And it set kind of a standard. So, you know, we're in the era of rapid cuts and no long shots. That's why a movie like Drive, that comes along with 30-second close-ups, is so startling to audiences now. It's like, wow, this is so radical and so new. Well, no, it's not. He's just giving his lead some time to act. And they don't do that much anymore.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're visiting with our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck, and we're talking about the films of 1962. And if our listeners want to chime in with some of their picks, I can just see so many folks scrambling to their computers to figure out if a certain film was actually made in 62.
63 doesn't count, folks.
To qualify for our show today. That's right. Jason Heck, why don't you kick things off here and talk about the epic you just mentioned, Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, this is a big deal because it's my favorite film of all time. Unimpeachably,
really?
Higher than any other movie, this is the one that holds my heart and brain in its hands, and I'm completely spellbound every time I watch it.
I did not know that.
Without any question.
Because?
Well, it's funny. Lawrence of Arabia, you look at it, and when you think of Lawrence of Arabia, what do you think of off the top of your head?
Desert.
We don't really think of specific scenes. We don't really think of memorable
dialogue.
That's right. What Lawrence of Arabia is about is and this is what David Lean could visualize, taking a 70-millimeter camera into the Jordanian desert to film a guy who is nothing more than a speck a mile away. And when we think about Lawrence, that's what we think of. We think of spectacle. We think of these long, thoughtful, beautiful passages in the desert. And that's what the movie is for me. That's the romance of this place, which is, as Claude Rains says, it's a hot, fiery furnace. People go out there to die. And Lawrence says, no, it's going to be fun. And Dryden says, it is widely recognized that you have a funny sense of fun. And what we have at the center of it is this very socially unconventional, very eccentric British officer who is a bastard child of an Irish nobleman. And he falls in love with the Arab culture, with the Bedouin culture in particular, and in the middle of World War I. You know, it's such a bizarre idea to even make it. As Omar Sharif said, if you are the man with the money and somebody comes to you and says he wants to make a film that's 4 hours long with no stars and no women and no love story and not much action either, and he wants to spend a huge amount of money to go film it in the desert, what would you say?
Wow.
That this movie got made is one of the greatest miracles in cinema. I am completely staggered. You know, David Lean had already done Bridge on the River Kwai, so he already knew exotic location filming. He already knew, you know, he was certainly an immensely talented filmmaker. His visual sense was extraordinary. But to make this movie, it just stuns me that it got made. Peter O'Toole, I'm one hetero dude. I will tell you, he is about the most physically attractive human being I've ever seen as Lawrence. He is like some sort of feral cat in how he looks. He is so sleek and beautiful, and I think that's an important part of his character. Mm-hmm. But you know, they looked around. Albert Finney had been sort of tossed around for this, and you know, the making a movie like this is an epic endeavor, and there's mm-hmm. all sorts of great production stories about it. But you know, Anthony Quinn, who plays Auda, the sort of brigand mercenary tribal leader, spent hours each day putting on his own makeup so he would look like this guy, and I first saw it in 1988 when the restoration came out. Robert Harris, the great film restorer, found
Jim Katz.
And Jim Payton?
Jim Katz.
Jim
right?
Katz. Yeah. Found a print in the Columbia Vault, and and Steven Spielberg was one of the people who bankrolled them into making this flawless restoration. I first saw it at the Oak Park Plaza, AMC's one-time flagship. And I went and saw it, and I think I was 14, and I went and saw it four times.
No kidding.
I just knew what I was seeing was so completely different and so alien to my experience, and it was magnificent. And it was a movie that you quite literally could fall into, and you would look at your watch and think, wow, I lost half a day here, but I never noticed it.
It is sort of a perfect 14-year-old's boy movie. I think that's probably how old I was when I saw it on a re-release. And it does just kind of capture you and take you away to this other place.
Can you watch it on the TV screen then today?
You know, we are blessed in having, you know, we are in the era of the 50 and 60-inch television and you know, Blu-ray. No, it ain't like seeing it on a 50-foot screen. The movie Lean knew what he was doing when he shot it in 70mm because this is a format that captures immense detail. And, of course, the movie's famous for these shots of guys on camels miles and miles distant who don't even sort of forsake – they're specs that don't even forsake their ambiguity for like 2 minutes. And you realize, oh, that's a guy on a camel coming toward the camera. So – the detail and the colors that he found in this desert, you know, I'm sure producers – Sam Spiegel believed in him, but I'm sure all these other execs were sort of, why are you shooting in the desert? It's going to be boring. Honestly, he finds 10,000 shades of taupe in the desert, and I can't even start to recommend this movie enough. It is easily, in my opinion, the greatest film ever made, but a lot of other people.
Is it on your top 10, Mitch?
I love Florence of Arabia.
No question about it. What's the clip we got here?
This is actually a wonderful scene. This is Sheriff Ali, played by Omar Sharif, and Lawrence has just led 50 men across the Nafud Desert, and he has gone back to rescue one. Sheriff Ali had protested, saying he's dead. It is written, and Lawrence has said nothing is written, and he goes back, risks his life, brings back this guy, Gassim, and he is now awakening at the oasis with Ali after having performed this remarkable rescue.
From Lawrence of Arabia.
El Orans, truly for some men, nothing is written unless they write it.
Not El Orans, just Lawrence.
El Orans is better.
True.
Your father too, just Mr. Lawrence.
My father is Sir Thomas Chapman.
Is that a lord?
A kind of lord.
Then when he dies, you too will be a lord.
No.
Ah. You have an elder brother.
No.
But then, I do not understand this. Your father's name is Chapman?
Ali. He didn't marry my mother.
I see.
I'm sorry.
It seems to me that you are free to choose your own name then.
Yes. I suppose I am.
El Orans is best.
All right. I'll settle for El Orans.
I see.
It's so good. You should rewatch.
That sounds great. What a nice way to spend some time. Lawrence of Arabia, Jason Hecht's pick for the greatest film of all time. Mitch Bryan, Cape Fear.
A slightly smaller film.
But
no less compelling. Yeah. In 1961, Gregory Peck was producing movies, as was Kirk Douglas and many other movie stars. And he got a hold of the rights to a book called The Executioners by John D. MacDonald, optioned it, and ultimately hired J. Lee Thompson, with whom he had just worked on The Guns of Navarone. J. Lee Thompson is very frank about saying he wanted to make a Hitchcock movie. And in fact, he went so far as to hire George Tomasini, Hitchcock's editor, and Bob Boyle, Hitchcock's production designer, ultimately Bernard Herrmann, Hitchcock's most famous composer, and created this starkly beautiful black and white lush thriller about a convict who gets out of jail and decides to exact revenge upon the prosecutor who put him behind bars, shows up in this sleepy southern town and begins to stalk and terrorize this this lawyer, his wife, and their 14-year-old daughter with lascivious intentions. Now,
and this film was remade
a whole bunch of years later. By Martin Scorsese,
Jessica Lange,
yeah, right. McNulty, and mm-hmm. Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
And in fact, Gregory Peck and Robert Mitchum both have cameos in the remake. Robert Mitchum had played an amazing villain in the film The Night of the Hunter. And so this is one of his two great villainous roles. He just oozes sleaze at every turn as he begins to, you know, terrorize this. And Gregory Peck, on the other hand, playing his, you know, it's the same year as he made To Kill a Mockingbird. So he owned the upstanding righteous guy part for 1962.
Right.
And he said he knew when they went into make this movie that the good part was the bad guy's part. And he said to J. Lee Thompson, you got to take care of me and make sure I don't get completely upstaged in this movie. They immediately ran into trouble with the censors. This again was a period the production code was, and the Catholic League of Decency were exacting extreme pressure on movies. So you had to meet with the censor in advance. You had to show the movie to your censor afterwards. And one of the things that was said was that the word rape could not be uttered because ultimately that was his desires on the daughter and the wife. So the film benefits from what can't be said, what has to be hinted at, what has to be intimated. And I'm not one of those people who says movies are always better when you can't spell it out. But these days, when everything is spelled out, there is something to be said for subtext. There is something to be said for the intention behind the line being slightly, you know, hidden. So it's a really terrific movie.
It's creepy.
It's a great 60s thriller.
Yeah. What's the clip we got here?
So this is Robert Mitchum playing Max Cady meets with Gregory Peck's character in a bar and sort of lies out what his plan is going to be.
This is from the film Cape Fear.
You know, when I was in the bucket, all I could think about was busting out and killing somebody. I wanted to kill him with my bare hands, slow. Every single night for 7 years, I killed that man. And on the eighth year, I said, oh, no, that's too easy. That's too fast. You know, the Chinese death of 1,000 cuts? First they cut off a little toe, then a piece of your finger, a piece of your ear, your nose. And I like that better.
A little toe, I'm to understand, child. That's it, isn't it?
Now, that's your train of thought, Counselor, not mine.
My train of thought. Shocking degenerate. Oh, I I've seen the worst. The dregs, but you. You are the lowest. Makes me sick to breathe the same air.
Well, that's from Cape Fear. And coming up in our second half today, Mitch and Jason will talk about the Manchurian candidate, Dr. No, the man who shot Liberty Valance and Lolita, as we continue our review of all the great films from 1962. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Steve Kraske. Monday on the program, some good rules for your marriage. This hour, we're talking with Mitch and Jason. That's Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck, our DVD gurus, about some of the great films of 1962. Why 1962? Because it was exactly 50 years ago. And that music is from
Dr. No.
Dr. No. How could you not get that one? Okay. Well, if our listeners want to chime in with any of their recollections of seeing Lawrence of Arabia, Jason Heck was so eloquent in explaining why it's his favorite film of all time during our first half today. You can give us a call here, 816-235-2888, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. We have a tweet at KCUR Up to Date. A listener wants to know, how much did movies change in the late 60s and early 70s when they started to be shown on television? Seems like a major game changer to me.
Well, a lot of movies changed in the late 60s. I mean, that was sort of the era of the studio going kaput and the young filmmakers rising up. But
yeah, I mean, you would wait for a long time for a movie to show up on TV, because the studios would re-release the movie every 2 or 3 years if it was popular, and so they didn't want to put it on TV until, you know, there were
– that was done.
That was it, right? So right. So I can remember, especially with the James Bond movies, we waited a long time before they showed up on television. And then, of course, they were edited for content, and that became the new problem, the new bugaboo with TV presentations of post-production code movies, was that, yeah, you know, everything wasn't acceptable for all audiences as far as the networks were concerned. And so right, it became that became its own issue.
I don't remember what a big deal it was. Like TV networks would pay tens of millions of dollars. Like I remember reading like The Empire Strikes Back, and this was 1980, was like $10 million was thrown out by CBS or whatever network bought it so they could show that movie on TV. Before all of us got cable, it was a pretty big deal to see a big movie on TV. I mean, like I remember seeing The Wizard of Oz on TV. It's like, wow, this is, you know, with no commercial interruptions, they would right, tout that. And that was a pretty big deal.
Let's move on with our list here this morning. And Jason, The Manchurian Candidate.
A movie almost as ambiguous as in many of its themes as Cape Fear. You know, it has become shorthand, you know, The Manchurian Candidate for, you know, we think brainwashing and everything right, else. We think incestuous communism. We think all sorts of things. It is a more complicated film than we perhaps remember. It is one of the very best political thrillers of all time. It is also surprisingly funny in some scenes. I think that Frankenheimer and his writers, the novelist Richard Condon wrote the book, and George Axelrod, who wrote the screenplay, they wrote a movie that was funnier than audiences might have been prepared for. Obviously, this came out in 62. JFK and Medgar Evers were assassinated in 63. The movie would sort of played out. There have been sort of these rumors that Sinatra, who had been buddies with JFK, you know, bought the movie and got it out of there. And I don't – bad memories. But in fact, the movie had been sort of played out by 63. The story is, of course, famous. We have Sergeant, I believe, Raymond Shaw, played by Lawrence Harvey, who is awarded the Medal of Honor for rescuing his entire rifle squad on a mission in Korea. Well, of course, it turns out that they were bushwhacked by elite Soviet paratroopers and whisked away to Manchuria, where they were all brainwashed. Raymond was made the perfect assassin, and his squad mates were implanted with the memory that he had saved their entire squad and was the kindest, bravest, warmest, and most wonderful human being they had ever known in their lives. Well, in fact, Raymond was a jerk. Raymond was very cold-hearted and completely socially awkward and a snob, and he was not any of those things. Well, Frank Sinatra plays Captain, actually Major, Bennett Marco, who was Raymond's platoon leader and who recommended him for the Medal of Honor, and he's having a nightmare. He's having a nightmare where he sees Raymond killing two of their squad mates in front of this audience of communist generals and leaders. He thinks it's pretty weird, wants the army to investigate. The army said, we don't investigate dreams, until he comes up with the fact that other guys from the squad are having the exact same dream. So It turns out that there's something going on. Something's very wrong with Raymond. Raymond's mother is no help in resolving this, however, because Raymond's mother is a communist agent who is married to a sort of blowhard demagogue, Senator John Eisland, a very McCarthy-type demagogue, played with clumsy relish by James Gregory, is the kind of dude who puts a lot of ketchup on his steaks. And we have Raymond, who is activated by a couple of code phrases. Why don't you pass the time by playing a little solitaire? And when he gets to the queen, he's activated and must commit the next action that is proposed to him by whomever. Now, If that's usually going to be something like kill this person and any witnesses, but it could be jump in a lake. The movie is unbelievably paranoid, atmospheric, incredibly gorgeous to look at.
Yeah.
Sinatra actually was sort of known for doing a great first take and sort of deteriorating after that. And there's this great scene, the famous scene where he is breaking down Raymond's conditioning by showing him a deck full of queens. And Sinatra was kind of out of focus on this first take. Well, Raymond at this point is deteriorating horribly, and he's a mess. He's killed the only person who's ever given him happiness. He has killed a senator. He is absolutely falling apart. And Sinatra was kind of out of focus in this shot. Well, turned out it was actually a pretty great decision to leave it in, because we get this perception that Raymond is not seeing the world as he should. A bang-up ending, one of the very best great surprise cool endings of all time. Great performances all around. Angela Lansbury was only three years older than Lawrence Harvey and probably didn't love playing his mom Sinatra at a Rosie Wanted Lucille Ball, which I think could have been really cool, but probably added to the funny part. William Frawley would have probably been a funny Senator John Eisland, actually, now that I think about it. But it's great. We have Janet Leigh, however, as this really kind of interesting love interest. She plays this gorgeous woman named Rosie who meets Sinatra on a train when he's been forced to take vacation. His hands are shaking too much to light a cigarette. He's just a mess. And she has this kind of bizarre conversation with him. This is sort of where the movie's ambiguity really plays with me, and I think it's a lot of fun. They start the conversation off with what certainly sounds almost like an exchange of passwords. And she has far more interest in him than should a normal stranger meeting another person on a train. So, you know, the rest of the movie, she sort of seems like kind of a romantic foil, but there's this scene that actually it's our clip where Rosie has this very strange conversation with Ben Marco and Sinatra. At this point, he's sort of sweating. He looks like he's in a trance, and her remarks to him seem to deepen that sort of stupor he's in and lead to just this fun level of gray and ambiguity. Is she an agent? Is she activating him? Is she on our side? Is she on their side? It's pretty great.
Okay, let's listen.
My name is Ben. Really Bennett. Named after Arnold Bennett.
The writer?
No, a lieutenant colonel. He was my father's commanding officer at the time.
What's your last name?
Marco.
Major Marco. Are you Arabic?
No.
Let me put it another way. Are you married?
No. You?
No.
What's your last name?
Cheney. I'm production assistant for a man named Justin, who had two hits last season. I live on 54th Street, a few doors from the Modern Museum of Art, of which I'm a tea privileges member, no cream. I live at 53 West 54th Street. apartment 3B. Can you remember that?
Yes.
El Dorado 59970. Can you remember that?
Yes.
See, not a lot of people are going to remember that scene, but I think that there are many, many levels that it's working on, and yeah. It's really fascinating to me because he's such a mess, and she is clearly trying to implant some information in him. I love it.
That's from The Manchurian Candidate, and just a note to our listeners, we posted the trailers to all these 1962 films that we're discussing today at kcur.org. Just look for today's broadcast under the program listings there. Let's go to a phone call here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. We're talking about some great films from 1962. Mike from Blue Springs, good morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to say I couldn't agree more with your choices. Those are also four of my favorite. Now, add in another one a couple of years later, Dr. Strangelove, and that's pretty much mine from the 60s. But what I wanted to ask you about, though, was your comments about the remakes of three of these, Lolita, Cape Fear, and Manchurian Candidate, and what you all think of that.
I was really pleasantly surprised by The Manchurian Candidate. I thought it added actually a nice change-up twist, but I thought it was actually I thought, oh, God, it's going to be like Psycho. These are movies that do not need to be remade. They are classics. I was really pleased with The Manchurian Candidate. I will let Mitch speak to the other two since those are two of his movies.
I understand why they remade Cape Fear, and there are things about the remake I like, but mm-hmm. I also think that it's overstated and it's sort of a dinosaur, and I prefer the faster, more nimble original version. Mm-hmm. And the remake of Lolita is completely wrongheaded, I think.
Okay.
And humorless.
So, looks like we get a single on this one. And
although James Bond, Dr. No was remade again and again and again, just with different titles and different gimmicks.
That's
so
true.
You know.
Good point. Mike, thank you for the call.
Yes, thank you.
Again, our number here, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org. Mitch Bryan, how about you just mentioned this film, Dr. No, the first of the Bond series,
That's right. 50 mm-hmm. years we've been watching James
my
Bond movies.
Goodness.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes, it is amazing.
Like
my life will be chronicled by the Bond series, 50 years, and also by Super Bowls. I was just old enough at Super Bowl number one to sort of know what was going on.
Yeah.
And as I go through, I remember all of them almost, which is, I don't know what that says about me. But,
yeah, I think that it's interesting to see after, three, four generations of these Bond films, every kid sees their first James Bond movie, and whoever that James Bond is probably the James Bond who they think is the best James Bond, right?
Right.
So we were fortunate enough to have Sean Connery, who may well still
was
be
the
best James
Bond. Was
although
best.
Daniel Craig is
not too bad.
Good.
Not too bad.
But, Dr. No is an extraordinary movie, and I think that one thing I will say before I even talk about the movie is if you really want to re-experience Dr. No in a way that you've never experienced before, the Blu-ray that is out, the transfer, you will see things that you never saw even if you saw it in the movie theater.
Wow.
The textures, the fabrics, the light, the location stuff in Jamaica is amazing. You can see a piece of trash blowing across the street in the background. It will make you really re-experience the movie. If there's only one Blu-ray that you look at, this is the one. It is just extraordinary.
Mitch gave it to me, and it was like the best present I've ever been given. it really is. I mean, we watch it in Mitch's in the man cave at Mitch's house in the basement on the big TV, and he was right. I mean, that A, high definition is almost 3D, but B, I mean, just looking in the opening scene in the casino, you look at the green baize and the felt on the table and the wallpaper, and it really is entirely extraordinary.
Wow.
They threw some major money at this transfer. This is not just kicked over from the DVD. It's mm-hmm. gorgeous to look at.
Mm. And I think the thing that makes these movies and makes Dr. No so radical for 1962 is how forward-looking it is. They had a brand logo for the character, the two zeros and the seven that look like a gun. They had the gun barrel signature beginning where he walks into the end of the frame.
Right.
They had a signature theme song for him. And then the production design by Ken Adam, who would come back and forth, but it would always be working with Sid Kane, who sometimes would take over those duties. A visual style that was very distinctive. And, of course, most importantly, this kind of tongue-in-cheek sense of humor – gallows humor that was dark and sexy, that they could get away with things because they would play the sexuality off with the joke, or they would play the violence off with the joke, and an editing style that had never been
tried before, which is a really fast editing style by Peter Hunt, which often uses jump cuts within the action sequences just to propel the action forward. So in many ways, I'm sure the film was shocking to audiences who first saw it, and probably a little disturbing too, given it came out in October as the Cuban Missile Crisis was happening, and it's all about toppling missiles and sending them off to places that you don't want them to go. So there's even a political, cultural connection there with what was really happening in the times. But Saltzman and Broccoli brought this series of books to the screen. The Fleming had been writing for 10 years, and they finally got this one, as the Dr. No, as the first one, because they felt it was the most economical. They made the film for really the equivalent of a couple of million dollars. I think they had £300,000, I think, for the entire budget. And they made a film that feels really big, that sweeps across the globe from Jamaica to Britain, that provides these beautiful sensual pleasures, whether it's, you know, whether it's Ursula Andress walking out of the ocean in the white bikini, or whether it is that green felt on the card tables in the casino when James Bond is gambling at the beginning. It's a sly, kind of perverse, wicked kind of movie on one level. And yet it has this beautiful kind of comic book dynamic with Dr. No, played by played by Joseph Wiseman. And Connery's just sort of breezes through this thing with this unbelievable air of confidence and you know, sexuality. He's just amazing.
And yet surprisingly brutal for a Bond film in terms of how he plays it, and kind of merciless. He beats the holy hell out of Dr. No's henchman at the beginning, shoots Professor Dent, who is completely unarmed, and essentially would have emptied his gun into him if the censors had let it pass. So I think it's an interesting sort of almost very brutal Cold War type Bond.
Well, yeah, like with the Cape Fear and Lolita, this was a film that they had to tangle with the censors over.
What's the clip we got?
So this is of course the iconic confrontation between James Bond and Dr. No over dinner and champagne.
Okay.
The Americans are fools. I offered my services, they refused. So did the East. Now they can both pay for their mistake.
World domination, same old dream. Our asylums are full of people who think they're Napoleon or God.
You persist in trying to provoke me, Mr. Bond. I could have had you killed in the swamp.
And why didn't you?
I thought you less stupid. Usually when a man gets in my way... You were different. You cost me time, money, effort. You damaged my organization and my pride. I was curious to see what kind of a man you were. I thought there might even be a place for you with Spectre.
Well, I'm flattered. I prefer the revenge department. Of course, my first job would be finding the man who killed Strangways and Quarrel.
Unfortunately, I misjudged you. You are just a stupid policeman. Luck is run out.
That's from Dr. No, as we review the best films from 1962 with Mitch and Jason. A couple of emails here. Don writes us at updatedat.kcur.org. As a child, I was a big fan of The Music Man. That was Ron Howard's best role, in my opinion. And come on, Don, it was Opie as Andy Griffith.
Village of the, Village of the Giants is the best. Come on.
Tom writes us, the best thing to be said for Lawrence of Arabia, what Zhivago does for snow, Lawrence of Arabia did for sand.
That's a pretty legit way to put it, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Jason, talk to us about the man who shot Liberty Valance.
Well, John Ford and John Wayne essentially created, over the course of about 10 films, everything that we think about the Old West. Started with Stagecoach in 39, and then you had the Cavalry Trilogy, Fort Apache, She Wore Yellow Ribbon, Rio Grande, and then Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is a very different movie for them. When you think of the John Ford Westerns, you think of huge sweeping vistas, you think of location shoots, you think of Monument Valley. This was shot on the Paramount backlot, which is strange because that generally implies a smaller budget, and yet he had two of the world's most bankable stars as his leads in John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart. We start off with Jimmy Stewart as a successful politician and senator who comes back to the town of Shinbone, which we don't quite know where it is. It's somewhere out west, to attend the funeral of sort of one of the town citizens, and we don't really know why a very powerful man would come back for the burial of this nobody, a guy named Tom Donovan. Well, the story is told in flashback, and Jimmy Stewart was, when he was just a young lawyer, kind of unconvincing, they didn't quite have the young makeup, really, comes into town and his stagecoach is bushwhacked by an outlaw named Liberty Valance, played by Lee Marvin. And he is pistol whipped and beaten up, and he is basically put back on his feet by a guy named Tom Donovan, played by the Duke, John Wayne. What's fascinating about the movie to me is it's two really interesting themes. One is we have the rule of law supplanting the rule of the gun in the West. We have law and lawyers kind of moving in, and the time of blood and bullets is sort of being pushed out.
Darn
and,
it.
And I know that's still how you settle your problems.
Yeah.
but it's interesting because we see that the gun is still necessary, that there are things that the law is too weak or it can't handle. And the other thing that we have essentially is democracy versus sort of tyranny or fascism. We have a whole town that is terrified by Liberty Valance and his two sidekicks, but they're not strong enough to do anything about it. Mm. Even the collective group, there's nobody to really stand up except this one guy, played by John Wayne, who kind of says, you know, sometimes you need to stand up to somebody. Sometimes you need to use a gun. Sometimes you need to sort your own problems out. And, you know, we see how the movie sort of switches from the Duke's point of view to Jimmy Stewart's as sort of the violence fades and Stewart becomes more successful. He kind of wins over the Duke's girlfriend, played by Vera Miles. The cast is amazing. We have John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, Vera Miles, Lee Marvin, Edmund O'Brien, John Carradine, Woody Strode, Denver Pyle, Strother Martin, and Lee Van Cleef. It's amazing, this cast. It's sort of the most thoughtful movie that John Ford made. His movies are kind of these wonderful self-contained things. But it has these sort of long passages where, you know, there is no great vista to look at. There is no great discussion. We're just sort of pondering what we're seeing. And what we're seeing is civilization coming to a town where it didn't exist before.
What's the clip we got? Hoss.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is John Wayne refers to Jimmy Stewart throughout the movie as Pilgrim. And we always sort of attach that as a stereotype to John Wayne. But here he's sort of saying something about Stewart's character, about this sort of insight when he calls him Pilgrim. We have, after being beaten initially on his way into town, Jimmy Stewart is awakening in the care of Vera Miles and her parents, and John Wayne is there, and they're just sort of talking about what life is like in Shinbone, the rule of law versus the rule of the gun.
Okay.
What did you say his name was? The man with the silver-knobbed whip?
I said Liberty Valance. But if that's what you gotta do, you better start packing a handgun.
A gun? I don't want a gun. I don't want a gun. I don't want to kill him. I want to put him in jail.
Oh. Well, I know those law books mean a lot to you, but not out here. Out here, a man settles his own problems.
No, but do you know what you're saying to me? You know, you're saying just exactly what Liberty Valance said. Kind of a community have I come to? You all seem to know about this fellow Liberty Valance. He's a no-good, gun-packing, murdering thief. But the only advice you can give to me is to carry a gun. Well, I'm a lawyer. Ransom Stoddard, attorney at law.
Man, what a voice.
And
what
he means
distinctive
it.
Voice.
Two distinctive voices in that one.
And the same theme as Cape Fear. They're examining the same ideas, like this bad guy, how are you going to stop him when the law can't help you?
Well, I hold in my hand the name of the last film our gurus are going to talk about today, Lolita, Mitch Bryan.
And as the poster said, how did they ever make a movie of Lolita? And Stanley Kubrick said after the fact, if he had known how difficult it would have been to have made this movie, he would not even have done it because it was nothing but a constant war with the censors, albeit, you know, what did he think he was going to get telling the story of a 40-something man who falls in love with a 12-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
They make her 14 in the movie, but it's still still a serious problem. Same problem as Cape Fear, too. Mm-hmm. This is Cape Fear. It kind of echoes both of these movies. But Lolita is an extraordinarily funny movie. Kubrick managed to outwit the censors in many cases, to do things through suggestion, and to sort of refocus the narrative and create this movie that makes you, forces you to identify with James Mason, who is in love with this girl, a little girl who's sort of tormenting him through the whole process, completely unhinged, completely immoral, marries her mom so he can get close to her. And Shelley Winters is unbelievable as her mother. It's just a terrific movie and just really funny.
And the clip?
And the clip. He's pursued and dogged through this whole thing by a character called Claire Quilty, played by Peter Sellers. And in this case, Humbert has arrived with Lolita at a hotel, and it's been tracked down by Peter Sellers, who's now pretending to be a cop.
May I say one other thing to you? It was really on my mind. I've been thinking about it quite a lot. I noticed when you was checking in, you had a lovely, pretty little girl with you. She was really lovely. As a matter of fact, she wasn't so little, come to think of it. She was a fairly tall little. Well, I mean, taller than little, you know what I mean? But she was really lovely. I wish I had a lovely, pretty tall, lovely little girl like that. I mean, it's
well, that's just my daughter.
Your daughter? Gee, isn't it great to have a lovely, tall, pretty, little, small daughter like that? It's really wonderful. I don't have any children or boys or little, tall girls or anything. I'm not even... Are you married?
Yes, I'm expecting my wife perhaps to come here.
May I say something? I thought you was looking a little uneasy at the desk there, and maybe I was thinking that you want to get away from your wife for a little while. I don't blame you. If I was married, I'd take every opportunity to get away from my wife.
Yes. No, that was not it at all. As a matter of fact, it's quite possible that my wife will not join me because when I left home, she was not very well.
Oh, gee, what was the matter with your wife?
Well, it's nothing, but she had an accident.
Oh, gee, she had an accident. It's really terrible. I mean, fancy a fella's wife having a normal guy, his wife having an accident like that. What happened to her?
She was hit by a car.
Gee, no wonder she's not here. Gee, you must feel pretty bad about that. What's happening? Is she coming on later or something?
Well, that was the understanding.
What, in an ambulance? Gee, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that. I get sort of carried away, you know, being so normal and everything.
That's from Lolita. We're out of time. Mitch and Jason, thanks for your time. As always, guys.
Love you, big guy.
You bet. That's Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck. A complete list of the films they talked about today are on our website, kcur.org. And on that same site, you'll find a list of independent foreign and documentary film critics, their picks for three to see this weekend. Monday on the program, some good rules for your marriage. We had help this week from KCUR's Kim Noble, Danny Alexander, Bill Anderson, and Maria Carter. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.